Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Amy Walter. You're listening to Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. And happy 4th of July weekend. We hope you all have a safe, happy, and restful break. Today's show is an encore edition of a program that originally aired back in March, all about the reforms made by the Democratic National Committee to the presidential nomination process. Now that we have one round of debates under our belts, I thought it'd be helpful to listen back for some context and to see how these new rules are working in practice. I'll pop in from time to time for some up-to-date analysis, so just sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Following the election of Donald Trump in 2016, the Democratic National Committee, henceforth referred to as the DNC, got a lot of flack for what was viewed as a monumental failure. And for Democrats, it was. But to understand what happened on election night in 2016 and how the DNC is working to avoid a repeat of that in 2020, we have to go back a bit.
Fourscore and 7 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent.
Okay, not that far, you guys. Let me set the scene. In 2015, Hillary Clinton is the heir apparent for the Democratic nomination. Big names like Vice President Biden and Elizabeth Warren decide not to run, and she faces a little-known Vermont senator.
Do I consider myself part of the casino capitalist process by which so few have so much and so many have so little? No, I don't.
Bernie Sanders, of course, he's a self-described Democratic socialist who no one in establishment politics took very seriously. Fast forward to early 2016 on the verge of the very important first caucus state, Iowa. Clear victory for Clinton would finally put the insurgent Sanders campaign to bed. That's not what Hillary Clinton got.
I stand here tonight breathing a big sigh of relief. Thank you, Iowa.
People of Iowa have sent a very profound message to the political establishment.
The Iowa caucuses were on February 1st, and not only was the result close, with Clinton winning by a hair, but there were allegations of fraud.
Yeah, we said people could have left. Maybe that's not accurate.
We want to make sure they counted everyone.
There were three people that left, so we do know that three people left.
So why wouldn't they recount? I just wanted to be accurate.
And ultimately, the Sanders campaign lasted much longer than anyone could have imagined. Sanders didn't formally endorse Clinton until July 12th, just 2 weeks before the Democratic National Convention and just 4 months before the general election.
And I intend to do everything I can to make certain she will be the next president of the United States.
With that endorsement, Democrats hoped to move forward as a unified coalition on their way to Philadelphia for the convention. That also didn't happen. On July 22nd, days before the convention, DNC emails were leaked, showing a bias by the party against Sanders. Like these quotes, for instance.
It's not a DNC conspiracy. It's because the Sanders campaign never had their act together.
And
he must be a Bernie bro.
That leak forced the resignation of then-chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. The Florida representative was even booed during a breakfast for her state's delegation.
Good morning, Florida! All right, everybody now, settle down.
Sanders supporters were enraged and tensions reached a boiling point on July 26th when they walked out of the convention in protest. That sentiment from some surrogates and supporters never dissipated, during or after the primaries.
One campaign, the Clinton campaign, was able to control all of the economics within the DNC.
The process was rigged.
The elections are rigged.
You're going to play tricks like this? Who are you?
I mean, since you want to go there, this is really about a DNC that lacks accountability and transparency, period.
So, was the process rigged in Hillary Clinton's favor in 2016?
You know, I'm not sure, Amy, that the answer matters.
That's Tom Perez, DNC chairman.
If people believe that the process in 2016 was designed or implemented in a way that helped Hillary Clinton, then that's game, set, and match. And that's where trust gets undermined.
Perez was elected chairman of the DNC in 2017, and his mission is to ensure that 2020 isn't a repeat of 2016. That doesn't just mean winning, it means reinstilling faith in the system for Democrats. And the DNC has done a lot of work on this front.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer that when you lose elections at scale, you got to watch the game film, figure out what went wrong, and address it.
I talked with Chairman Perez recently about the reforms the DNC has undertaken.
We have redoubled our commitment to a 50-state strategy. We made unprecedented investments in this midterm cycle that enabled us to have historic gains up and down the ballot across the country. I'm proud of our investments in Kansas. And I'm proud of our investments in the industrial Midwest. I'm proud of our investments in Latino, African-American, Asian-American communities. I'm proud of our investments in rural America that enabled us to make real gains. We're also dramatically overhauling our technology infrastructure. What is here at the DNC now in terms of technology is night and day different and better from what we had even 2 years ago. And so we learned a harsh lesson. And the lessons were this. Number one, you have to be a 50-state party. Number two, you have to be a 12-month-a-year party. All politics is personal. You've got to develop relationships. You can't show up a month before the election, remind people to vote. That's transactional politics. That's not relational politics. And because we helped build an every-state infrastructure, because Democrats were organizing in every zip code, you look at how governor's races went in places like Michigan, Wisconsin, and elsewhere. You look 2 years earlier and how Secretary Clinton didn't do as well in these areas, and Democrats this time around were able to do much better. We went to school on what had happened in the preceding 8 years, and we've learned from it, and we're continuing to win elections. And I'm bullish going into 2020, but I'm also very, very mindful of the fact that we have more work to do.
You do believe that it was infrastructure more than it was the candidate that was a problem for the Democrats in 2016?
Well, I think you have to ask a broader question, Amy. What happened over the course of years that resulted in the loss of roughly 1,000 net seats in state legislatures? Mm-hmm. We had 60 seats when Barack Obama took office in the Senate. We ended up with 48 at the end of 2016. We had far more governorships, and we lost those. We were losing elections up and down the ballot. So the question we asked wasn't simply what happened in 2016. The question was, what took place in the years leading up to 2016? And what took place is, you know, we became, as a DNC, the party whose mission was solely to elect a Democratic president every 4 years, as opposed to what our current mission is, which is to elect Democrats up and down the ticket from the school board to the Oval Office, and to have an every zip code strategy, and to make sure we're organizing every day of every year, not just every fourth summer in the run-up to a presidential cycle. And I think the change of that mission statement, the investments in organizing, the investments in technology, the investments in voter protection, and the partnerships that we've been able to build within the broader ecosystem have enabled us, I think, to really have a great run in 2018, and we are building on those successful elections moving forward.
You spent a good chunk of your early days as DNC chairman having to both apologize and soothe some of the more disgruntled members of the Democratic community. I was reading during 2018, as you were out on the trail, you went and argued, this is a quote of yours, "We took too many people for granted." You specifically noted African Americans, that you frequently took them for granted. So I'm wondering, how much of your time now are you spending still sort of relitigating or apologizing or reassuring your Democratic constituents, and how much of your time is focused forward?
Well, I'm a big believer, and my parents taught me this, and my work as a prosecutor over many years taught me this, that honesty is the best policy. And when I got to this job, I thought it was really important to listen and learn. The honest reality was the DNC and the Democratic Party fell short in many ways. And my job was to rebuild infrastructure and to rebuild trust. And that's exactly what we have done. And I was very candid in acknowledging our shortcomings and taking ownership of those shortcomings. And you see the reforms we did in 2018 to the superdelegate process. We're going to have six states that did caucuses last time that'll do a primary this time. And as a result, more people will vote. I think we've been able to earn people's trust back. And trust is, that's something that is a timeless journey. Everything you do, every day I am here, making sure that we're fair to everybody. We have to understand that that is a 24/7 job. That is how we build trust in the brand. And I think we've been able to win elections because people understand that it's the Democrats who are fighting for healthcare for all. It's the Democrats who are fighting to make sure if you're diabetic, you can keep your health insurance. If you're diabetic, we're going to try and bring down the cost of your insulin. It's the Democrats who are fighting for good schools in your neighborhoods and for, frankly, an America that works for everybody. And people are trusting our brand more. People see that we are working hard to treat everyone fairly. And I think we saw those results in the 2018 cycle. We have more work to do now, and that's exactly what we're doing.
Okay, so we just heard about a shift in the mission of the DNC and efforts to rebuild trust. But some of the most tangible changes to the process have come in a new set of rules that the DNC will use to govern the nomination process. From the debates,
if there are 16 candidates who make it in June and July, then we'll go 8-8 on consecutive nights, and we will use random selection to determine who is there.
So there's no A team and B team.
Right. No varsity, JV, yeah. Varsity. And this is what we'll do for the first two.
To the caucuses.
Our North Star here is we want to return our power to the grassroots. That's why we will have more primaries and less caucuses.
And perhaps most controversially, superdelegates.
I think the best way to do it is to go back to 2016. Let's say we're 2 weeks before the Iowa caucus. So not one vote has been cast across America. At that point in 2016, as you turn on the TV and you would have an indication that candidate A has already amassed 400 delegates to the convention. The concern was that no voters had weighed in, and already the existence of superdelegates had put a thumb on the scale and it put people at an operational disadvantage. And so fast forward to January of 2020, superdelegates will not be counted on the first ballot unless a person has gotten the majority of the delegates already. And so what that means is on January 20th, 2020, nobody has any delegates to the convention.
Right. So it starts off. Candidate X has zero. Candidate Y has zero. Everybody starts at zero.
Everybody's got zero.
Even though they may have privately gotten assurances from people who are official superdelegates that they are going to support them.
But those superdelegates will not count on the first ballot unless that person has gotten the majority of the vote.
Tom Perez, chairman of the DNC. All this hour, we're talking about reforms undertaken by the Democratic National Committee to make the 2020 nomination process better. DNC Chairman Tom Perez talked about the debates, caucuses versus primaries, and superdelegates. So a delegate is basically a stand-in for voters. They represent the regular people. Superdelegates aren't awarded based on how a candidate performed in a state or caucus. They are party leaders who get to choose anyone they want, regardless of the votes that candidate won. After 2016, many Democrats wanted to get rid of superdelegates altogether, saying those unelected representatives were rigging the system in favor of the establishment favorite. But my colleague, Dave Wasserman from the Cook Report, notes that it's the way Democrats allocate the regular delegates, those people who represent the voters, that's just as problematic for the party.
Well, a big reason Donald Trump was able to wrap up the Republican nomination months before his convention was that Republicans give states the leeway to allocate most or all of their delegates on a winner-take-all basis. The Republican Party's much more about free markets, right? And so that really helped Donald Trump win large shares of delegates with small pluralities of the vote. For example, he won all 50 delegates in South Carolina, even though he only won 32% of the primary vote there. On the Democratic side, everyone's a winner as long as they get 15% support or more. So they get a proportional share of delegates. And that makes it very, very difficult for a Democratic frontrunner to establish an insurmountable lead.
And the change in the superdelegate rules, which will prohibit them from casting a ballot at the 2020 convention unless the outcome is uncertain or deadlocked, could actually backfire.
The irony is that the rule change might be addressing the wrong problem. Superdelegates could have even more power than before if there's a split convention and no candidate has a majority of delegates, which, given the front-loading of the Democratic calendar and the furious pace at which candidates are raising money, could very well happen. And even though superdelegates aren't allowed to vote on the first ballot, if you have a split convention, they could be the deciders on a second, third, fourth, or even successive ballot. So this carries enormous risks for the Democrats if you still have the party fighting amongst each other with little more than 3 months to go before the general election.
You and I have also had conversations about a long, drawn-out process that could have implications going into the general election in the way it did in 2016, where a candidate that does not end up winning the nomination but has a lot of fervent supporters, got a lot of delegates, may not feel as inclined to rally around the nominee because they sort of feel like over the course of the campaign, their candidate was not treated well.
Right. And today's Democratic Party is desperate to beat Donald Trump, but it's also highly fractious. You have Democrats who don't want a septuagenarian or a coastal elite to be their nominee. You have Democrats who insist on nothing less than a Green New Deal and Medicare for all and disbanding ICE. You also have, I think, a new element of Democratic primary voters who are moderate Republicans whom Trump has converted to Democrats in the last several years. So these groups are at odds, and I don't think there's one Democrat out of this zillion-way field that's going to make everyone happy.
A lot of Democrats' response to your concerns is, we know how important it is to defeat Donald Trump. And at some point, it's going to become very clear who the most viable candidate is, and our voters will get behind that one person. Are you skeptical that this idea of electability will help to really winnow this field in a reasonable way?
Well, that's more or less what happened in the 2016 Republican primary, because Republicans were so desperate to beat Hillary Clinton that they did rally around their frontrunner in Donald Trump. And if Democrats do have a breakout candidate, that could happen. But the reality is, if Republicans had played out their 2016 primaries under Democrats' delegate rules, they would have almost certainly headed to a contested convention. And so the rules really do make a big difference, and particularly Democrats' proportionality rule.
Dave, let's play the scenario out that a number of candidates, we don't know how many it will be, but more than two, make it into the final round of the primaries, and no candidate has been able to capture 50% of the delegate vote. But there will be one candidate who has the most raw votes and the most delegates. So won't the superdelegates just go to that person?
It depends who that person is, right? If it's Bernie Sanders, there will be Democrats in the superdelegate realm who don't like the party's lurch to the left. There's also a large contingent that really wants a woman to be the nominee. I think we learned in 2018 that Democratic voters believe the best way to send a message to Trump is to send a woman. And even though a brokered convention in Milwaukee might not be the single most likely scenario, there's a higher than usual chance of that occurring. So these factors really could play into Donald Trump's hands.
Because the longer this process drags out, the better for Donald Trump. They're not focusing, Democrats aren't focusing their fire exclusively on him.
And if we learned anything from 2016, President Trump is an expert when it comes to prying open cracks in the Democratic coalition. His campaign invested heavily in Facebook ads that depressed enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton among certain demographic groups. It's possible that there will be deep fissures in the Democratic coalition entering the general election once again.
Do you think that Democrats may be overcorrected from 2016 and that they're going to regret the fact that they were thinking too much about that race and not enough about what a 2020 contest could look like?
Well, it's possible that Democrats haven't overcorrected, but rather are trying to solve the wrong problem. If you go back to 2016, Hillary Clinton didn't need superdelegates to put her over the top against Bernie Sanders. It was the perception that the party insiders had gamed the process for her that really damaged her in the general election. But by giving superdelegates a say only on the second and successive ballots, Democrats could actually be heightening their role if no one reaches a majority on the first ballot.
David Wasserman, thank you for coming and explaining all of this to us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've been talking about the reforms the DNC has undertaken in its nomination process. And last week, we got a look at how those changes actually played out during the first round of Democratic debates.
You know, there had to be two nights of debates with 10 people on stage, which meant that at most a candidate got about 10 minutes to speak.
That's Alexandra Jaffe, a political reporter for the Associated Press. She was in Miami watching the debates firsthand. And when we spoke afterward, I asked her about whether or not this format worked.
It worked about as well as it could have, considering the size of the field. I mean, part of the problem with the qualification metrics were they were low enough that 20 people were able to qualify on sort of both metrics, polling and fundraising. That said, candidates were still able to make sort of the most of the little time that they got. We saw some breakout moments from candidates I think a lot of Americans probably hadn't been introduced to before. I mean, Andrew Yang did get his time in the sun to speak yesterday. Even Marianne Williamson interjected herself into the debate a bit. I think it was sort of the best that could be expected considering the unwieldy field we're looking at.
What did the campaigns think about this in terms of the numbers of people on stage?
The campaigns were a little bit frustrated with the lack of time. I heard in particular from Bernie Sanders' campaign that they felt that he could have done much better with a longer time to speak, and they were sort of looking forward to future debates for that opportunity. They felt he couldn't get deep into the weeds on policy in a way that he wanted to with just, you know, 30 seconds of follow-up.
And Alexandra, what do you think the audience for this debate thought about these two nights?
You know, I wasn't able to speak with any audience members in the crowd particularly, but I was talking to friends, I was texting with family members, and all of them did want to see more of the candidates. They were a little bit taken aback by how much it devolved as candidates tried to get their time during the second night, and so felt that they just didn't have enough time to really get introduced to these candidates, which, if you think about it, is somewhat good. I mean, that's exactly what these candidates, you know, especially the second-tier candidates, wanted to come out of the second and first night of debates. They wanted sort of voters wanting more and going online and researching about them. So overall, though, I think it was frustrating all around. It's definitely increased interest in the primary, which was, of course, the ultimate goal.
Right. So at the end of the day, do you think then the DNC comes out of this first round of debates looking pretty good?
I think they did about as well as could be expected considering the circumstances. I mean, there is still frustration, of course, with Steve Bullock not making it on that first debate stage. I, you know, saw a lot of tweets, heard a lot of comments, even from some advisors there, that he should have been part of the conversation. But things change, qualification sort of requirements shift for the next debate, and Bullock's team seems pretty confident he's going to make it on stage. And those qualifications will probably actually winnow down the field quite a bit. So we may also get more time for the candidates and put some of those concerns from their campaigns to bed.
Yeah. Can you walk us through the qualifications as we move into the next round of debates?
Sure. So candidates will need at least 2% support in four polls and 130,000 donors, and that's unique donors, with at least 400 each in 20 states. So that sort of expands the number of donors, expands the map, and also expands support in the polls, which, you know, you got to say, if you're not hitting those metrics in September, it's hard to argue that you're not a serious player in the primary.
Right. But it's likely as we go to the end of July debate that there still will need to be two nights. There'll be too many candidates to fit on one stage. Is that fair to say?
At this point, I would say it's fair to say, unless anybody craters, especially if they do want to give the candidates a little bit more time to talk and get into some nuance. So it will still be another big debate just because this is a huge field.
Alexander Jaffe, thank you so much for sitting down with me and talking through this.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Okay, here's another change that will impact Democrats seeking the presidential nomination. DNC Chairman Tom Perez told me that some states that previously held caucuses will now hold primaries.
Our North Star here is we want to return our power to the grassroots. That's why we will have more primaries and less caucuses. I firmly believe that when more people participate and primaries have larger participation, that's good for our democracy.
So first, some definitions. What actually is a caucus and how is it different from a primary?
Well, a caucus is actually a meeting. You meet at a certain time in a certain place, whereas a primary is a vote. You go in and you vote privately.
That's Jeff Link. He's participated in a lot of caucuses. We're going to come back to him. But first, let's turn to Jim Messina, longtime Democratic political strategist, Obama 2012 campaign manager, who thinks it's a good thing that some states, such as Minnesota and Colorado, are swapping the caucus for a primary.
That alleviates one of the concerns that we are going to nominate someone who's not in the mainstream. As you know, candidate Sanders beat candidate Clinton in all the caucus states and lost in most of the primary states.
But didn't candidate Obama do really well in the caucus states?
He did tremendously well in the caucus states, but he also did pretty well in the open states as well.
Messina's point is this. Caucuses tend to attract the most committed partisans and activists. These are the people who are willing to spend several hours on a random weekday to cast just one vote. Those activists tend to be motivated more by ideology than your everyday primary voter. On the Democratic side, they're usually much more liberal than the party as a whole. On the Republican side, more conservative. Caucuses are also less expensive for candidates than traditional primaries. That's because the universe of potential voters is also smaller. You don't need to spend millions of dollars trying to reach them all on TV. The most famous or infamous caucus, however, is not going away. That caucus, of course, is Iowa. After the problems of 2016, Democrats in the state have made some reforms on things like transparency of votes cast and an ability to cast a ballot without having to show up at a caucus. I asked Jeff Link, a longtime Iowa Democratic strategist, about the role that Iowa plays in the presidential nominating process.
Iowa has been a place where those who beat expectations can sometimes become the winner. And with this large a field, I think everyone sort of expects the current frontrunners of Biden and Sanders to do well. And there is a huge opening for any of the other 18 candidates. Like, who gets third? Does one of the names that are not so familiar now get second or actually win the caucuses? So we could see somebody come from nowhere.
Or the other is not that someone does unexpectedly well, but that a candidate does unexpectedly poorly.
It could. It's a double-edged sword. One of the scariest things to have in Iowa is an early lead because you've got to maintain that lead. And if you don't, I mean, remember Howard Dean in 2004 was ahead for a long time in Iowa and dropped at the last minute, and John Kerry ended up winning. And really, the Dean campaign spiraled downhill very quickly after that.
Do you feel it when you're in your own caucus? There's like an actual energy there for a candidate. Can you really get a sense of, I think so-and-so really is going to win this thing?
You absolutely do. And I'll tell you one story from 2008. I was at my precinct. Senator Harkin happened to show up with Senator Durbin from Illinois. The Clinton people all showed up. The Obama people were kind of milling around, but there was a line that extended from the gymnasium all the way out the door, literally outside, and that was the line for people trying to register to vote. And I remember walking Senator Durbin out the hallway to look at the line, and I said, I think your candidate's going to have a very good night tonight. Obviously, Barack Obama surprised a lot of people by winning the Iowa caucuses, but you could feel it in the room at our precinct.
Jeff Link is a Democratic strategist from Iowa.
Iowa. Iowa, 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 Iowa,
this year, I talked with political reporter Maggie Severance about the ways in which emerging Democratic candidates were trying to set themselves apart by swearing off outside corporate PAC money.
One thing that you're seeing this cycle is a lot of Democrats, as they enter the field, they're putting all these rules on how they raise money. And they're doing this to really make a statement saying, you know, I'm not the candidate of the rich.
3 months later, the first debates are in the rearview mirror, and the results of the second quarter fundraising are right around the corner. So I checked back in with Maggie to see how the crowded field of Democratic hopefuls has managed to balance early campaign pledges with the realities of running a presidential campaign.
As the campaign wears on, I think that candidates really want those same things. They really still want to be, you know, staying away from corporate PACs. They still really want to be, you know, pleasing voters that want them to not take this corporate money. But they all really need to be raising a ton of money. And there's this increasing pressure to show that you're the kind of candidate that can raise a ton of money.
And with Iowa caucuses still 7 months away, these campaigns need to be able to finance their operations through February and beyond.
Candidates are having to hold more and more fundraisers. Some of them are really doing it at a breakneck pace. And they're having to take all these kind of steps in the direction of raising more big money while trying to still kind of cling to their ethics. And so that tension is just kind of building on the campaign trail. You know, one thing that we saw recently is that Bernie Sanders is for the first time holding big in-person fundraising events. And that doesn't mean that, you know, Bernie Sanders is now kind of in the pocket of only big donors. But what it does mean is that during the 2016 campaign, Sanders raised money almost exclusively online. And he is going to start holding these in-person events. And that kind of, for the first time, gives wealthy people the opportunity to show up and shake hands with Bernie Sanders. And some of those kind of in-person back and forth exchanges are going to start to happen.
And is the same happening with someone like Elizabeth Warren, who's also been very vocal about her desire to eschew money from corporate or other sort of special interests?
So Warren is, again, she's, you know, really sticking to her principles. She really outlined these things that she's not going to do. And she has, next to Sanders, done the most to kind of say, I'm not going to hold any closed door fundraisers. But one thing that we've seen from the Warren team is that other members of her team, so not Elizabeth Warren, kind of other people, might be in touch with people, well-connected individuals, say, you know, in Hollywood or the Bay Area or other people who say, hey, I want to raise money for Elizabeth Warren. And they might kind of be reaching out to the campaign saying kind of, how do I do this? How do I do fundraisers? So you're seeing a desire for her campaign to have those big checks coming in.
Right. And now they're competing with 22-ish other people. It's no longer just a one-on-one kind of competition.
Yeah, and you know, they're competing with Joe Biden, who is this huge, going to be this huge fundraising juggernaut. You know, we don't know exactly how much he's going to raise. We won't know that until mid-July. And Joe Biden is expected to be really top of the field. He has all these connections from these Obama fundraisers and other folks who have just known him for a really long time. And in addition to that, Biden has indicated that he's actually been able to build up a grassroots network. I think he said that he has 200,000 donors who have given less than $200 apiece. He's also taken a really interesting and different step, which is that his campaign announced that it would be holding closed-door fundraisers with rich donors, but it decided that it would be having a press pool at those events. And it's for a limited part of the fundraiser. It's not like you get to kind of walk around and ask everyone questions and see everything that happens. And another thing is that it has kind of helped feed this illusion of Biden as a front runner. You know, a press pool is traditionally reserved for a president. And by Biden doing this so early on, it's kind of helped feed this image of Biden as being the front runner in the race.
But as you've also noted, because you were actually Pool recently, being transparent also means that reporters hear you say a lot of things that you might not necessarily have been saying in a speech or press conference.
Yeah. So last month, Biden was in a fundraiser and he made a couple references to working with Southern segregationist Democrats while he was in the Senate. And those got him in some real trouble. You know, he was trying to kind of boast about his ability to work with anyone. And instead, it really kind of fed this image of Biden as being a candidate who is kind of A, stuck in the past, B, racially insensitive. Biden the next day, and this is kind of when I was doing Pool, he refused to kind of bend or walk back those comments, he went into another fundraiser and he made them again. He doubled down on his comments. Having this press pool has worked for him in a number of ways, but for him, for Joe Biden, I think that some people thought that it would help kind of keep him on message when he was at these events. But lately, he has been going off message anyway, and then the things that he says get blasted out to dozens and dozens of national reporters, and they wind up on Twitter and they wind up in the press.
Tell us a little bit about what's going on the other side. It was reported soon after the president had his reelection kickoff in Orlando that he had raised something like $25 million in 24 hours.
Yeah, so this is a real area of concern for a lot of Democrats because, you know, he raises money from big donors, but Trump also has huge amounts of small dollar support and people who are really supportive of him. And he has now a year to keep raising money for his campaign and keep building out a campaign infrastructure before the Democrats decide on a nominee. And so it's going to be a big operation. It's not going to be like the first time that Trump ran for president when he kind of had this kind of ragtag campaign operation and wasn't really about the money. And that's not really why Trump got elected. This time he's really embracing the money side of things and embracing that that's part of what you need to get things done.
I'm curious what you think of this. My theory is that once the next quarter filings are made public, that we may see a thinning of the Democratic field. Do you expect to see something like that, that this next quarter's filing is maybe the last for a number of candidates?
You have to think so. And you can kind of, it's so tempting to guess who some of those candidates are, but I'm not going to go there right now. But it's hard to run a campaign. I think that it's hard to keep raising money when people aren't getting behind your campaign. And, you know, at the start of this year, a lot of these senators could transfer $5, $10 million in for their Senate account. And that gave them a really nice cushion to go on and to run on and to hire staff and get these campaigns going. You know, as the year goes on, someone like Kirsten Gillibrand is one example, is, you know, she's going to keep spending down this campaign account. But if she can't be raising huge amounts of money to compete with someone like Sanders, who raised $18 million in the first quarter, Biden, who will probably surpass that level in his second quarter, you know, if you can't compete with that, if you're in the second or the third tier, which, to be clear, these second and third tiers tend to be half that, if that, it's just hard to stay in the race.
Maggie Severance, thank you so much for coming in and talking with me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So let's zoom out a bit. I was curious what the role of the DNC is these days and how it's changed over the last 25 years. And for that, I brought in my friend.
My name is Jamal Simmons. I'm a host on Hill TV and a Democratic strategist. So I've had a lot of conversations with people who were involved with the DNC the last time the Democrats unseated a sitting Republican president, which was 1992.
On this day, with high hopes and brave hearts, in massive numbers, the American people have voted to make a new beginning.
And the role of the DNC at that period, they were pretty clear, was to set the table for the nominee. It's to figure out where the key voters are, in which states are winnable, where those voters are, pull all the lists together, do some oppo research on the Republican president and start to find some messaging that could work going after that president. So laying the groundwork for how do you actually campaign against the sitting president. So that is, I think that still would be a smart role for the DNC to start to do those things. What's different now, obviously, the money is very different. I was just looking back at 2004. I was involved in the campaign that raised $1 million in the first week, and we thought that was an impressive number.
Right now, if you don't raise that in the first 10 hours,
exactly,
you're a loser.
If you've raised less than $1 million in the first day, you're a loser. And now $1 million isn't even really that much. I mean, between Beto and Bernie, they've really done 5 and 6 times that amount of money. So the money's different. Less of it's going to the party. More of it's coming from small dollar donors. Now, the party can still raise money from some of the wealthier donors that maybe candidates don't want to be seen with very often. So you may see more money from the big tech companies, the big Wall Street giants, you may see them going to the Democratic Party instead of going to the nominee's actual account. That's a different state of play.
So what advice do you have for Democratic candidates? Now we're talking post-primary.
Yeah.
Going up against a president and a campaign that is not following any of the traditional rules. How do you prepare for that? And how do you respond to that?
Well, one of my rules about politics that I learned from Bill Clinton a long time ago is that there is no referee in politics. There's nobody calling ball strikes or fouls, nobody giving out penalty yards and that kind of thing. When you get attacked, you have to respond. And how you respond will depend on which campaign, which candidate is the nominee. But you can't choose not to respond. I think John Kerry maybe learned that lesson the hard way in 2004 when he was being swift voted. You've got to fight back. You know, one big thing that is different today than was true in, 10 years ago or even, is there's much more focus on the staff and the supporters of a candidate than there used to be.
Hmm.
There used to be a little bit of an unspoken rule that, you know, we're not really going to, my campaign's not going to attack your deputy campaign manager. Now, unless that person does something that's really flagrant that you want to go after, but we're not running oppo projects on staffers. I'm not sure that's holding. That's something people now are much more willing to go after staffers. They'll go after donors. Pretty much everybody in the arena is now fair game.
And do you think this also happens in a primary where it's not simply the staffers, but who the staffers are? There's been a really concerted effort by many of these candidates to show that they have diverse staff. They have women sitting at the table. They have people of color sitting in positions of influence. How much of that is going to be important, do you think, to voters?
It matters because those candidates are going to end up having to deal with issues wherever they are that will be much more pungent than they were before. So if there's an issue that impacts, let's say, criminal justice reform, Hillary Clinton faced this, right, in 2016, whoever the candidate is could get a question about Black Lives Matter in New Hampshire, where there aren't that many Black voters. But if there aren't people around, they haven't thought through the question, and they get that question wrong in New Hampshire, people in South Carolina and Alabama and Michigan and other states are all going to know it. And so you just got to have a staff built that's prepared to deal with the current ebb and flow of the Democratic Party. I've gotten a couple of calls from friends who are thinking about working on campaigns, and they are worried about their personal professional history. So, for instance, someone worked for a bank, a Wall Street bank, and now they want to go back and do a campaign. And so the question is, do you think that I will be attacked or I'll become an issue in the campaign because I used to work for XYZ Bank and now somebody on the other side will say, look at this candidate being influenced by these bankers?
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing that Democrats are talking about a lot, which to me feels brand new, are some of these process arguments about structurally about our political system, the Electoral College, size of the Supreme Court, voting age. And these are the sorts of things that activists talked about all the time. And sometimes they'd get raised, you know, if you've been on a campaign trail, you've heard people raise some of these issues. But I've never seen a time where so many candidates themselves are also openly saying, yes, we need to get rid of the Electoral College. Yes, we need to expand the size of the Supreme Court. Yes, we need to get rid of the filibuster.
So one thing, you hear Elizabeth Warren talk about this. She used this in her speech at Morgan State University earlier this year.
It's time to change the rules. It's up to us. Rules matter. And you have the power to make this country a more perfect union, to make it be the nation you want it to be.
It's not just about playing the game better. We actually have to change the rules of the game because the rules of the game may be tilted away from working people and the majority of the people in the country. This idea that our group is being disadvantaged by these rules that have been put in place for so long, and so we're going to have to not just play the game better, but also change the rules. Donald Trump has a similar perspective from the conservative side, the right, who are people who think the rules have been stacked against a bunch of these disaffected workers around the country, particularly white workers around the country. And so it's interesting that I think what is happening is because there are so many benefits that are being accrued by people at the top of the income scale, everyone else is feeling put behind and left out of the game. The question, if you're a Democrat or a Republican, a conservative or progressive, is who do you blame? Do you blame government and the lobbyists and all the people who are the government insiders? Or do you blame big business and the folks who are at the top who are on Wall Street and who are making all these decisions? And I think who you blame determines what side of the aisle you're on.
Jamal Simmons, thank you so much for coming in and talking to me.
Thank you for having me. This is great to be here.
Jamal Simmons is a host for Hill TV and a Democratic strategist. All right, here's my take. When it comes to covering a primary, the media spends most of its time focused on candidates, their personalities, their policies, and their blunders. But winning candidates spend a lot of their time focused on the unsexy stuff, how to leverage the rules to their advantage. For example, Barack Obama's campaign in 2008 realized early on that the delegate rules meant that the caucuses were going to win him a lot of delegates, even if they didn't garner as much media attention as big primary states like Pennsylvania or Texas. This year, Democrats have a lot of new written and unwritten rules to figure out. One unwritten rule: how to raise lots of money without looking beholden to corporatists and the one percenters. Thus far, it's meant that no candidate has been able to raise the sort of eye-popping fundraising numbers as candidates Barack Obama in 2007 or Hillary Clinton in 2015. Now on July 15th, the second quarter fundraising reports are publicly available, giving us another chance to see which candidates are thriving and which are struggling to keep up. The new debate rules meant that almost every candidate got on stage, but only a few of them really broke through. The debates did not fundamentally reset the race, but they did give us a benchmark for evaluating these candidates over time. Who wears well and who withers as the campaign gets into higher gear. That's all for us today. Thanks so much for listening. This is Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. See you next week.